Welcome to the Real Python Podcast. This is episode 303. How many attempts have been made to remove Python's global interpreter lock, or GIL? How do they compare to the current approach? Christopher Trudeau is back on the show this week with another batch of PyCoders Weekly articles and projects. Christopher shares a recent article about Thomas Waters' talk at PyCon US 2026. The talk, titled Free-Threaded Python, Past, Present, and Future, covers the efforts to remove the GIL starting in 1996. He explains that threads are complex and they allow multiple tasks to run concurrently within a single process and its address space. The GIL is how CPython implements threading. The GIL protects Python objects and their reference counts, which determine the current objects in use. The talk also looks forward and shares the current work to remove the GIL, now named Free-Threaded Python, and the goals for the near future. We also share several other articles and projects from the Python community, including new releases, community announcements, a roundup of recent RealPython tutorials and video courses, using UV in production, employing Wagtail as a Django admin on steroids, managing and measuring Python code quality, a pure Python implementation of JQ, and a project to bring interactivity to Plot9. This week's episode is sponsored by Ori from Endor Labs. If you're writing code with an AI coding assistant, Ori catches vulnerabilities, blocks malicious packages, and keeps secrets out of your code. Free to get started at endorlabs.com. All right, let's get started. The Real Python Podcast is a weekly conversation about using Python in the real world. My name is Christopher Bailey, your host. Each week, we feature interviews with experts in the community and discussions about the topics, articles, and courses found at realpython.com. After the podcast, join us and learn real-world Python skills with a community of experts at realpython.com. Hey, Christopher, welcome back.
Hi there.
All right, so we got a full boat. Today we got our news, we got some real Python news, I got a little tiny piece of follow-up, our typical topics and projects. You ready to dig in?
Yeah, let's do this.
All right. What do you got for news?
I think we need a news jingle. I want I want something earwormy that gets stuck in people's heads. You know, the kind of thing that when somebody sees a new pep, they get PTSD and they're humming our intro for the rest of the day.
Okay. Right. So not the typical
I want something. Yeah, I want something catchy. So I'll leave that up to you to figure that out. So that's a to-do for you.
Thanks.
And so pretend we have one. And our first bit of news is a PEP. PEP 836 is titled JitGoBurr, the path to a supported JIT compiler for CPython. I will leave my editorializing about using memes in the titles of PEPs alone.
I think that might be Savannah right there.
So a couple of weeks ago, the core developers decided that the experimental JIT had reached a stage where a bunch of questions needed to be answered before anything more would be allowed into the main branch. There was a mild kerfuffle online, but for the most part, the JIT folks just kind of dug in and started writing. The end result is this PEP, which outlines what measures will be used to determine if the JIT should make it to the production branch. The key goals are improving method tracing, making the JIT free threading compatible. Spoiler alert, we're going to come back to that. And a bare minimum of a 5% speed up for the JIT with the GIL in next year's 3.16 release. So that's the first target. And then the second target is two-phased, both of which are attached to 3.17 betas versus RCs. And they want to move that 5% up to 20%. So they're really hoping that this makes a big difference inside of your favorite interpreter.
All right.
So these are some lofty goals, and let's hope that they hit them.
Nice.
The next two bits are quick. For starters, the first batch of PyCon US videos has been uploaded to YouTube. So if you missed the conference, again, spoiler, we're going to get there as well. or if you were there and there was something from the other tracks that you wanted to check out, you can go look at online on YouTube to see those. And the other quick bit has to do with the PSF board elections in the fall. So we mentioned this before, but the PSF is now running two office hour sessions dedicated to the topic of board candidates. So if you want to learn more about what it means to run and what's involved in the job, you might want to attend. The first of those two sessions will have happened by the time this podcast comes out. We're right on the boundary. But the second session is August 11th. Okay. So you won't need a time machine to attend that one if you're interested. So
nice.
And that's all I've got. So what's happening at RealPython?
All right. So yeah, got a little bit of RealPython news here. A little bit of a shorter list this time, but the first is by our friend Leodanas Pozo-Ramos. It's titled, How to Get Started with the GitHub Copilot CLI. The GitHub Copilot CLI brings AI-assisted coding into your terminal. Unlike the older GH Copilot extension, which only suggests and explains shell commands, the Copilot CLI is a standalone agentic app that answers questions, writes and debugs code, interacts with GitHub.com services through natural language prompts. And for Python developers who feel at home on the command line, it offers a quick way to plan tasks, edit files, and run agentic workflows without leaving the shell. So nice written tutorial by Leodanas there. The next one, I'll just mention the name of it. It's called Managing and Measuring Python Code Quality. It's a video course by Nagar Vahid. And I'm featuring this one a little later in the episode, so just stay tuned. I won't talk any more about it. But that's in the lineup here. The next, we go back to another piece by Leodanas. It is one of our Python 3.15 previews covering the upgraded JIT compiler. That might sound familiar here. Python 3.15 is sharpening the experimental just-in-time compiler. And with it, it's adding a new tracing front-end, basic register allocation, in-place int and float operations, tighter machine code, and more. And in this tutorial, you'll learn how to enable and benchmark for the 3.15 JIT on your own machine and explore what makes it faster. And through that, you'll set up a 3.15 build with the JIT compiled in and run a quick benchmark to see the speed up on your own machine. Then you'll walk through each optimizer upgrade and verify the numbers against the official PyPerformance suite. So if you're interested in digging into the JIT and trying it on your own, this might be a good guide for you to follow along. Next up is a video course. It's by Rodrigo Hirao Sorau. And I mentioned this one as a video course in the spotlight last week, if you were listening. It's titled Testing MCP Servers with a Python MCP Client. So here's just a quick summary again. Building an MCP client in Python is a great way to test MCP servers directly from your terminal. So in the video course, you build a minimal MCP client for the command line. It then connects to an MCP server through the standard input-output, the STDIO transport. It will then list the server's capabilities and interact with server tools, prompts, and resources directly and deterministically. So if you're interested in learning a little more about MCP or setting it up through Python, there's a great video tutorial for you. The next is kind of rounding up a whole bunch of stuff about code management this week. We have a piece by Rahil Mahataji. It's titled simply, How to Use GitHub. When you work on a local Python project, tracking your changes with Git is a great way to maintain the history of your code. However, keeping your repository only on your computer leaves your work vulnerable to hardware failures. It also makes collaboration difficult. So by learning how to use GitHub, you can back up your work, share your code with the public, and potentially work alongside other developers. You'll learn how to not only build your own GitHub repository and connect it to your local projects, but also the steps that are involved in starting to collaborate with others online using GitHub. A quick piece of follow-up. I had Brett Cannon on the show recently, episode 297, and we discussed his work around three different PEPs. We talked a lot about his process of going through submitting these things and supporting them and getting them passed, or, you know, maybe not in some cases. And we focused at the end of it about PEP 832, which is about virtual environment discovery. And there's been a lot of conversations, some controversy, and in general, some moves toward collaboration. So if you're interested to read an update and his thoughts, he has written up a post about his promotional work. And in his first sentence of the piece, I think it's kind of funny, he writes, I thought I would write out why I'm even bothering with any of this. So it's on his blog, snarky.ca. It's titled Why I Wrote PEP 832 Virtual Environment Discovery, and dives into the details there. His site's full of great stuff, so if you have a chance, check it out. All right, ready to dig into our regular topics here? Yeah, we're coming right back to features in new Python here.
Yep. So my first article is by Jake Edge, and it's titled Free Threaded Python, Past, Present, and Future. And it's a summary of a talk given by Thomas Waters on gil removal given at this year's PyCon US. This talk is one of the videos that got posted that I mentioned earlier. So that's what I meant by, you know, a little spoiler alert. We're talking about the gil, and spoiler alert, you can actually go watch this video firsthand if you want to see the talk itself rather than read the summary. Free threading is the brand name for the ongoing project of removing the gil from Python. In case you don't live and breathe Python internals, the gil stands for global interpreter lock. Because Python supports multiple threads, there's a chance for race conditions when those different threads all try to do memory management things at the same time. This is made more complex by the nature of the fact that Python supports plugins written in lower level languages like C, which of course can have their own threads and also need to touch those Python memory things. So the gil is a big lock that makes sure that only one thing is mucking with memory at a time. That's a gross oversimplification bordering on a lie. And this prevents certain kinds of errors, but it also limits the amount of concurrency that can happen. So even if you have threads without locks on them, your interpreter itself can create a choke point inside of the system calls. Since Thomas's talk was at PyCon, he, like me, didn't want to make assumptions about the audience's knowledge, and he starts out with a quick overview of threads and why the gil exists. At the end, he points out that the gil doesn't even solve all the problems. It really only addresses part of the memory issue and does not guarantee that your code itself is thread safe. And those extensions I mentioned, well, if they're not written in a certain way, it doesn't protect them either. So to quote him directly, fundamentally, threads are hard. I think I'm going to get that on a bumper sticker. So the gil helps in certain cases.
Could have a sound effect too.
It could be. Yes, yes, yes. The gil helps in certain cases, but not all. And of course, makes threads less useful. So part of his concern with the gil is actually that developers incorrectly rely on the gil thinking it solves all problems, and they end up with race conditions anyways. One alternative would be to move the locking mechanism into the objects that are getting locked. So instead of having a global lock, you've got a bunch of little local locks on, say, things like your dictionary object. This could be very expensive for non-threaded programs, slowing down the single-threaded performance by a lot in order to make threaded programs faster, and that generally isn't going to fly. So Thomas goes on to talk about the history of the gil. The first attempt at removal was in Python 1.4. Mm-hmm. So I suspect, based on our demographics, that about half of our listeners weren't even born. So it turns out we've been arguing about the gil since 1996.
Wow.
So the first approach used that fine-grained locking concept that I just talked about. The attempt worked in theory, but in practice, the cost to single-threaded Python was almost 50%. It was way too high, and so they ditched it. Another attempt was done in 2013. Which tried to move all of the memory reference counting stuff to after the thread has been executed. This, of course, only worked for shorter term threads and was based on a green thread model, meaning it wouldn't work with threads from the operating system. So this really only solved one case and not all of them. And so this attempt didn't go anywhere. 2 years later, in 2015, another project kicked off called the gilectomy. I think this was the first time I was aware that this stuff was going on, was the gilectomy. I remember this. This played with a couple of different approaches over a couple of years, but eventually figured out that it was just, again, it wasn't solving all of the problems, and so it got abandoned. The current attempt started with a no-gil fork of the interpreter in 3.9. So yeah, again, this is far older than I think anybody thinks it is, right? That was 5 versions ago. So part of this approach associates an object with an owner thread. And this is kind of clever. So if the object is being accessed on the owner thread, you don't really need the locking because it's local to its own space. And then if the object is being accessed from a different thread, then you take a slower, more protected path. And so this means the locks are only kicking in certain cases. And if you're sticking with local access, then you're not going to pay a lot of cost on it. In addition to that, they did some smaller grain locks have also been put in place, and a bunch of changes that have been made to the garbage collector to just sort of improve things overall. So the end result is the no-gill got rebranded to free threading. And in case you're curious, one of the reasons they renamed it was that turning off the no-gill would result in conversations with confusing double negatives. For example, no, turn it off. There should be no no-gill in our code. See what I mean? Confusing.
Yeah.
So that was the past part of past, present, and future. The next part of the talk gives an update on the current state of free-threaded Python. Last year's 3.14 release saw free-threaded mode perform at only 10% slower than the no-gill mode. So that's still slower, but that's a lot better than the 50% we're talking about a couple decades back. There's still lots of work to be done, particularly as extension developers need to update to use the new API in order to take advantage of free threading. And of course, they're also still trying to optimize it all so that the single-threaded case is performing better. Going free-threaded by default is not a foregone conclusion. There is a path to it. The steering council wants to see how effective this thing is before making a decision. Thomas is pretty confident that it will happen. I'll finish by quoting him directly. He said, "I think this is far into the future. This is next decade, but that's what I expect. But you know, I might be surprised." So let's hope so, and maybe it'll happen before that. And you know, when I read that, one of the things that went through my head was, oh, the next decade, that's so far off. And then my brain went, wait a second, it's halfway through 2026. The next decade's not that far off. So that's not as scary a sentence as it sounds.
Yeah, it's kind of wild. Like, you know, a lot happens within a decade. Tell me about it here in America. but also, it sure creeps up on you when you're not focusing on it, you know.
Yes.
Yeah. Lots of things are changing and happening all the time.
Yeah. There's a quote from Lenin I like, which is, "Some decades nothing happens, and some years decades happen."
This episode is sponsored by Ori by Endor Labs. AI coding assistants have changed how fast you can ship, but security doesn't automatically come with that speed. Packages don't always get vetted. Credentials end up in the code. Vulnerabilities slip through. Whether you're writing Python, JavaScript, or anything in between, Ori plugs into your editor via MCP and catches all of that in real time, so you're not finding out about it after you've already shipped. Free to get started, and teams using it see 10 times fewer security tickets. Head to endorlabs.com.
All right, so my first piece is focusing back on something we've talked a lot about in the recent past, which is UV. And I found it as a really interesting article because it kind of looks at it from an organization embracing UV versus individuals kind of using it. The piece is by Oleg Zvetkov, and it's on his blog. It's titled "UV in Production. The speed is real. The integration isn't free." So I'll read from the first line of the piece. UV, Astral's package manager, is 10 to 100 times faster than pip in benchmarks. On our CI, our continuous integration, it was more modest, about 10x. I think no one is surprised by that 10x anymore. It's the main feature, right? The idea not buried under a spoiler, he says, is UV stays. We're not rolling back. The speed is worth it, but the speed promise is kind of the easy part of the deal. And his CI system went from, in this particular example that he's using here, from 60 seconds to 3 to 5. So again, definitely 10 times or more of a jump. And again, that part he feels is free, built into UV, it's built in Rust, and so forth. And then he has 5 caveats that were things that he was not expecting to happen, being a longtime user of pip. And I think this is useful for those that are looking to move systems from pip to UV that they might not have thought about. This is about a CI pipeline, and they've used pip for quite some time, so you might consider just general growing pains. But that's why I wanted to cover it. I think it's kind of a nice way to kind of look at it. And it's actually a really well-written piece. It's rare that I see a website that has a button for English and Russian. at the top that you can switch them back and forth. But I think this reads really well. So five caveats, the loudest first. UV won't install without an active VENV or virtual environment. It'll say no virtual environment found. With no active virtual environment or VNV, PIP will quite happily install into the global or user environment, and UV won't. I think that's a good thing generally, but it might be a big surprise for some people that are using, say, virtual machines or using Docker, where this idea of having it land into the global environment maybe makes sense because there aren't a lot of different users. There aren't a lot of different setups and so forth. And again, it's a change, but it can be bad for individual users. And so I can kind of see what UV is trying to do. And again, it goes back to a little bit of the Brett's conversation before of us sort of steering toward that.
In fact, there's a environment variable you can set that will make PIP behave that way as well. And I've got it set on all of my machines so that I don't accidentally install into an environment I don't mean to install into.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you just have to specify. So if you know VENV, you activate one, or you use specific flags, dash dash Python, and then you put your path to Python or dash dash system. There is no dash dash user, which I think is kind of interesting flag. I didn't know that. It doesn't recognize that at all and rejects it on site. So what if you forgot to activate the VEN? UV doesn't guess for you and doesn't reach into the system behind your back. It just stops. So again, it might sound trivial to make this change, but they have 20 different services and Docker files and repos that they're having to migrate into this. So they had to think about it. So that was like kind of the biggest first initial pain point here. If you're used to installing into a Docker type environment, we're installing into the system Python and not managing virtual environments, this might be a really new process for you. The second is auto installing Python. Firewall dislikes it, but it's fixable. UV can download in the interpreter or download a version of Python as you need on its own, and pulling it on demand from Astral's Python-build-standalone, that's great. You'd think finally a universal way to get the right Python version into an image or any distro, but this works, you know, easily on your own personal laptop that has, you know, Wi-Fi and internet connection. But what if you're inside of a corporate setup, and he calls it the this works up to the first corporate perimeter. No outbound access, no Python. So, you know, what if you're in a lockdown CI, it's going to stall. There's a fix. This is a built-in one. The flag in this case is UV_Python_install mirror. And the variable repoints where UV fetches these releases, and you could use it to like an internal mirror if you want. There are some more details on setting this up. Maybe you're using PyPI instead. That's something he mentions inside there. The solution here is making this sort of proxy repo and pointing UV to look for that mirror. Number three is parallel installs now get serialized. So UV's cache is concurrency safe and append only. So it kind of goes back to your idea of locking and dealing with that before here. PIP is a little bit more of a serial thing, and one of the speed ups that we talked about that they're looking at, but UV had already done, is it can do a bunch of stuff in parallel. And so it locks the virtual environment during this install, is I believe what he's trying to say here. So as it builds these individual artifacts, it's been locked, so nothing overwrites them halfway through. PIP didn't do this, and parallel installs into one environment could, in theory, break each other. This is like the third pain point that he felt. He didn't necessarily see this all the time. It showed up in places where he wasn't checking in some scenarios. They would hit the same lock, line up, and start collecting timeouts. And so there is a feature. You can either try to cut down on parallel access, or you can raise the UV lock timeout. They chose to do both in their case. The next two are kind of quick. Number four is index order, first index by default. UV runs in first index mode. It takes versions only from the first index where the package turns up at all and looks no further. PIP gathers candidates from everywhere and picks the best one. So this can form a problem that we were dealing with before with squatting issues and typo stuff, where if you have a corporate package, a malicious package could get introduced to PyPI that squats that exact same name, and maybe potentially the tool would not grab from your internal repo, but grab it from PyPI instead because it has the same name, and maybe it shows a newer version or something like that. there are some flags to bring back the pip-like behavior. And it's also what PEP 766 is trying to standardize. The last is bytecode compilation is off by default, so it means a cold start is a little slower than pip. At install time, pip is going to compile the .py to .pyc right away, so UV doesn't do that. Default compilation is lazy on first import. There's a single flag compile-bytecode. Astral explicitly recommends turning it on if you're doing Docker builds to fix these cold start issues. And since they recommend enabling it for anything that ships to prod anyway, it's not hard to notice how good leaving it off makes the install benchmark look. So again, that 100 times thing that you see with the speed up, there are things that pip is doing that UV isn't doing that might, and again, initially help with some of the speed. It brought some really genuinely noticeable things. Yes, the speed, 10x, again, did I mention it was written in Rust, they say. Managed Python, honestly, a good thing with an asterisk. Good once the mirror is up. Before mirror is the pain from caveat number two they mentioned there. And then building and publishing through UV, they like that also. We moved some packages over to building and publishing with the UV commands. And it was easy to swap from Twine, one tool where there used to be several. So UV stays, we're not rolling back. The speed is worth it. But the speed and promise is the easy part of the deal. The expensive part is these sort of behavior, non-obvious behavior changes behind the scenes. And they mentioned, you know, a little bit that is unique here. Also, UV is moving fast, maybe even faster right now, now that I've been acquired. And the specific flags and environment variables and defaults could well have shifted by the time you're reading this. So something to pay attention to, things to consider if you're going to set up UV and use it in a CI system. All right, what do you got next here?
My next article is called Wagtail as Django Admin on Steroids, and it's by Tim Kamanen, who is the very well-named site Tim on Web. So good choice. So if you haven't come across it before, Wagtail is an open source CMS, that's content management system, that's built on top of Django. I know the core devs might cringe at this analogy, but think WordPress for Django. So Django itself really is a CMS framework, so this might seem like a bit of a hat on a hat, but Wagtail is actually aimed at a different crowd. It's much more enterprise-ready as a CMS and includes things like article workflows, reusable content modules, tools for common things like contact forms and surveys, image library management, and more. So it is a hat on a hat, but the second hat's fancy. So what I didn't know and what Tim's article is about is just how much Django admin-like functionality that Wagtail has. So Django comes with tools for mapping Python classes to tables in your database. The Django admin is a web-based GUI for managing those objects, and it gives you the ability to create, update, and delete the items in the database. The admin, though, is a little clunky. It has a very old school look and feel and is meant for people who understand the tool rather than your general end users. There are third-party libraries out there to make it look prettier, but at its core, it's meant for administrator types rather than the general public. So Wagtail provides similar functionality to the admin, but being built on top of the Wagtail interface, it's slicker and you get the pretty. Although it is a CMS, it is still very much a Django framework. So you write similar code for it as you would to Django projects. So it doesn't, like if you know Django, picking up Wagtail isn't particularly hard. So for example, the admin tools that come with Wagtail are almost drop-in replacements for those same classes in Django. You define an admin object class that maps to your database object, and the framework takes care of the rest. Wagtail calls this mapping a snippet view set, but like with the regular admin, you decorate the class to map it, you specify what fields from the objects show up in the columns on the page, how many objects show up on a paginated page, and what fields are searchable, and all that kind of good stuff. Wagtail has a concept called a panel, which is a way it describes segments on the screen, including fields in a form. And these panels are very, very flexible, which means editing the interface part of your super admin can have lots of control and you can do a lot more with it than you could with the regular Django admin. Another bit of beauty here is versioning. So by adding a mixin to your Django model, Wagtail will store a history of changes to your model, allowing you to see how things have been edited over time and undo mistakes of the past if you like. If only my life had versioning.
Yeah.
Anyways, and that stuff only touches the surface. There's also a rich text editor, easy customization of the base templates, enhanced permission management, and a lot more. So I will admit to complete ignorance of all of these features and am definitely going to take another look at Wagtail. Thanks to Tim for making me aware that this stuff existed.
Yeah, actually, I hope to be talking to a couple people from the Wagtail project soon. You had met Megan at a conference or
a meetup. Yeah, Toronto's meetup, Python meetup. Yeah, she gave a great talk there.
Yeah, cool. So we're still in scheduling, but hopefully soon. It's time to shine a spotlight on another Real Python video course. It's on the topic of threading, which we touch on this week. Threads share state in your programs, which mean race conditions can be created when two or more threads fight to update a value. This course is about the various primitives you can use to ensure atomic access to your program's shared state. And the video course is titled Thread Safety in Python, Locks, and Other Techniques. It's based on a tutorial by Adarsh Divakaran. And in the video course, my co-host Christopher Trudeau shows you what race conditions are and how to avoid them, how to identify thread safety issues in your code, what different synchronization primitives exist in the threading module, how to use synchronization primitives to make your code thread safe. Real Python video courses are broken into easily consumable sections, and where needed, include code examples for the techniques shown. All lessons have a transcript, including closed captions. Check out the video course. You can find a link in the show notes, or you can find it using the search tool on realpython.com. So my next one continues a bit of theme on managing and looking at code. And a switch here to a video course. This is by a previous guest, Nigar Vahid. She was on the show to talk about quantum computing in Python not too long ago. This video course is titled Managing and Measuring Python Code Quality. It has a companion written tutorial that goes a little deeper into all of it. So I'm going to kind of combine a review of both of them here. The written piece is titled Python Code Quality, Best Practices and Tools, and definitely gets deeper into the tooling. Whereas Nigar's video course is talking about the concepts of these things, how to think about Python code quality, managing that yourself. And I feel like this course and this tutorial are these things that you might want to check out if you've done the basics and you're starting to move toward this intermediate path and you're wondering, well, what do these standards look like? Or maybe you're coming from another language and you wonder what this is like inside of Python. Okay, so what makes code high quality? High quality code is functional, it's readable, maintainable, efficient, and secure, adhering to established standards and has good documentation. That's kind of the crux of a lot of this. And so it digs into these best practices such as descriptive naming, consistent coding style, modular design, robust error handling, and what are the types of tools? Like I said, in the written tutorial gets further into the stuff like linters, formatters, and profilers, and how they can assist in that. The examples are used throughout to start with. They are like little short code pieces and definitely have that kind of side-by-side type of thing showing you like, okay, well, what do you think is a better quality? Which would you choose in this? The first piece is functionality. Does your code actually do what it's supposed to do? Does it provide results? And in a lot of cases, like how does it handle edge cases? That's why you might put like test cases in to make sure that stuff's working properly. An example would be like managing types is one of the first things they get into here. If you're getting user input, you need to convert those strings potentially into floats or integers before you're doing math and stuff like that. The next piece is all about readability. Could future developers or future you understand your code without any kind of struggle? Code readability is one of these core principles behind Python. It's one of the reasons that I really like the language, and I think a lot of people are coming to it. It's interesting to me that the AI world has definitely embraced this, and I think this might be one of the reasons, because you can create these human-readable files. These ideas are embedded into the Zen of Python, which you've mentioned a few times on the show. Quality code is readable, meaning another developer or you could read it later, and you can look at it and quickly understand the logic and its purpose. So they bring up PEP 8, the official style guide for writing clean, readable, and consistent Python code. And we've often hit that on the show. So if you're interested, I'll include some links here about PEP 8. So the next is efficiency. Does your code scale cleanly without crashing? Does it use the right data structures and appropriate algorithms? And this is something that moves toward potentially, you know, getting your code working and then maybe looking at refactoring it. And is a little bit tied to this next thing of reusability. You know, can you reuse the same logic again and again without copying and pasting or rewriting it? And throughout this video course, we've started to add a lot more exercises inside of them, things that you can kind of challenge yourself as you work through them. So you get a coding challenge along with most of these steps as you go through it with these blocks of code and look through like, okay, how can I make it higher quality based on these things? There's a short section about avoiding security mistakes and then checking code quality. And I think this is really where the written piece by Lay It On Us picks up the ball and takes you into a very in-depth section of best practices that gets into the tools and techniques for you to check out. That section of his article is called Applying Best Practices for High Quality Code in Python. It has a table at the beginning of it that summarizes all these strategies and has some of the steps for you to follow for higher, again, writing this higher quality Python. For example, like one of the rows is readability. So it's got a strategy column that says, okay, use descriptive names for code objects. Resources for you, column on that, PEP 8, and links to these resources. What are some of the tools and techniques you could use? You could have code review, have other people looking at your code, potentially using AI assistants to help with review. And then the same holds in this table of like documentation and reusability and maintainability and testability. So it also has these great sections full of tools and links to resources, style guides, again, code reviews, AI assistants as part of that, potentially there. Code linters, if you haven't heard of the term, they analyze your code for potential errors, things that people refer to as code smells, patterns that people do that potentially may look or be potentially problematic in what you're writing. Adherence to coding style guidelines like PEP 8. So code linters are a very handy tool, and we'll talk a little bit more of them in a second. They also catch, you know, syntax errors, code style violations like indentation or spacing or naming. Maybe you have unused imports or you've set up variables or names and you're not using them later in your program. The complexity of your code, we've talked about code complexity on the show. There's lots of tools there. It goes much further. It adds links to a few of these tools, PyLint and Flake 8, and then Ruff, which is a tool also by the people from Astral that combines a bunch of these tools together. Type checkers are mentioned, code formatters. We've mentioned the tool Black that will help reformat your code to be sort of standardized by a set of rules that you can set up, or you can follow the standard. Code testing, code profilers. So it's this real catch-all article that I feel like people, again, that are moving from beginner status into intermediate status want to have ways to improve their code potentially, or look at ways that are some of these best practices. So thanks, Vahid, and Lay It On Us. One of the other things I mentioned briefly is a vulnerability checker. And that's something I'm looking at too, because as you start to look at maybe putting your stuff up on the web, now you got other potential sources of things that you need to look at. So there's this tool called Bandit that I've heard of a few times that is a handy tool to kind of like, again, just check for the security and potential vulnerabilities that you might be missing there. So I wanted to ask you just briefly, like, what are the tools that you're using for code quality? And
so I use Black on occasion. I use it with some of my libraries, but not all. Don't ask me how I've decided when and if. It seems to be kind of arbitrary.
Yeah, we definitely use it at RealPython. So
yeah, Black to me is one of those that is like, you can smell the compromise. Like some of the formatting is like, I can't imagine anybody actually likes that. But rather than argue about it, everybody uses the same thing. And that's kind of the purpose.
Yeah.
I use a modified version of Flake 8 called PyFlakes. It's a little less picky. So I found it didn't scream as much about certain things that I didn't care about. So like Flake 8, because it, like, for example, use of things like constants and stuff like that, PEP 8's very particular about some of those things. And sometimes I don't always do them. And so I found PyFlakes kind of just set the value at the level that was comfortable for me.
Okay.
I've heard good things about some of the more modern tools, but I just haven't had a drive to try them out. On the code smell side of things, I don't generally use it personally, but often with my clients, I'll get them to install a SonarQube, which is a static analyzer. And it does sort of like a letter grade, and it does certain kinds of vulnerabilities and code smells and that kind of stuff.
The complexity stuff we've talked about before, too. Yeah.
And a couple of my buddies that I've been talking to, they seem to be moving away from that and towards some of the LLM tools, depending on what they have access to. So like a friend of mine works for one of the very large organizations, and they were allowed access to Fable. And so like now they're using it and finding all sorts of things that way. I would be curious to see how well, everyone talks about how great that tool is, but I would be curious to see is how much it catches that SonarQube also catches.
Yeah.
Because I have found with most of my clients that turn on those kinds of stuff, what happens is they get overwhelmed with the number of things that it says you should fix, and then they just turn the tool right back off. So the fact that the AI tools are now finding all of these things doesn't mean they're going to get corrected. So I am curious to sort of see how that's going to progress.
When you're doing more like Django type of stuff, were there other tools that you were using, like you mentioned SonarQube, but that look for vulnerabilities that are more internet potentially based?
If I remember correctly, SonarQube does have some of that stuff built into it.
Yeah.
It's looking for a lot of common pieces out there. It's not just things like cyclomatic complexity. It also does like snippet matching, right? So it looks for bad patterns and goes, oh, no, code shouldn't look like that. Yeah. So I think there are certain kinds of vulnerabilities out there. The guy who I was talking to about Fable said, you know, one of the things that was showing up all the times was like, this is a hard-coded credential and you shouldn't have those. So I know the LLMs are catching some of those things as well.
Yeah.
So
that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had a previous sponsor, Sneak, and a lot of people were bringing that up early on that does some of the testing your code and looking through those type of security vulnerabilities. And I had heard about Bandit also. But yeah, I wonder how much of that will be subsumed, you know, potentially, or if it will be a bit of a game of catch up. I feel like all this AI stuff is, unfortunately, the pricing structure is finally shifting into something that, like, oh, that's what it's really going to cost. And so, you know, a subscription to some of these other services or potentially, you know, trying them out for a couple of months, it may make more sense. I don't know. It'll be an interesting time to kind of see, but.
And the other thing I'm a fan of, and again, it's more of my clients rather than something I bother with myself, but is fuzzers.
Oh, yeah.
So these are things that like randomly submit random data to your forms on your webpage or whatever.
Yeah.
Because they're throwing random crap into it, they tend to catch things like, oh, you didn't escape that character properly. They tend to cause crashes. Those are good. And there's tools like Chaos Monkey, which for live servers will like intentionally break stuff.
Right. Plug and unplug things, kind of, yeah.
Yeah, and so if you're supposed to be recoverable, which at scale you're supposed to be able to do, then those things will trigger those kinds of pieces, and then of course your server either recovers or it doesn't.
Yeah.
So there's a good selection out there depending on what scale you're operating at. Yeah.
All right. Well, let's dive into projects. What do you got for a project this week?
Well, before I talk about my project this week, I need to talk about a project.
Sure.
It's actually a non-Python project to start out with. So there's a tool called JQ, and although that its name smells of JavaScript, it's actually a C-based compiled program. You use it to run specialty queries on JSON data, hence the J and JavaScript smell. So if you normally use like grep or sed or awk to muck around with JSON, then the JQ might actually help you out. So a JQ query allows you to state which parts of some JSON you're interested in and then return that value and then operate on it as well. So for example, if you had a JSON dictionary with a list of people in it, you could write a command that gets the first name field from the third person in the list. So JQ allows you to do that. For those familiar with XML, it's kind of like XPath, but for JSON. The JQ language is quite rich, and you can make modifications to values, run little expressions, do math, search based on regexes, so pretty powerful kind of thing. Hmm. So now that you know that JQ exists, that leads me to my project this week. It's called Pure JQ, and this is by a gentleman who goes by the GitHub handle Adam2Go. His profile photo is a shot of someone, I assume him, taking pictures in a very savanna-looking landscape. I don't see any lions, but it wouldn't surprise me if there was one just on the outer boundary of the picture. But I'm not here to discuss lion photography. I'm here to discuss Pure JQ. The thing is, there's not much to say. The pure part is because it's a pure Python implementation of the JQ tool. And as such, most of what needs to be said, I already said, because it works in Python, but it does what it needed to be do. So you can use Pure JQ on the command line, just like JQ, and drop in replacement. Or since it's Python, you can also use it in your code. The library works by using the same kind of query strings that you would put on the command line. You just call a function and pass those in. And it also includes a compile mode, which is kind of like compiling a regex. So you can give it the query, it'll compile it into a binary thing, and then it's reusable and faster. So there are a couple other libraries out here that have attempted something similar, a Python interface to something like JQ. But it turns out all of them have taken the extension approach. So they are Python bridges to the JQ library. And it turns out that the cost of crossing the C to Python boundary is more expensive than just letting Python do the work. So Pure JQ tends to be significantly faster than other versions out there. His benchmarks are showing like multiples of 4 or 5 times and higher than that in some cases. Adam2Go's code claims to pass 96% of the original JQ's test cases, so he's just a few points off of having perfect compatibility. If you muck around in JSON a lot, you should definitely take a look at JQ or its faster Python equivalent from Adam.
Yeah, it sounds cool having a query language for JSON in some ways, depending on what data you're working with. Yeah.
Yeah, if you're doing a lot of like data science-y connecting to APIs kind of stuff, you can get huge things back. And this gives you an SQL-ish kind of approach to digging into the data. Yeah.
It's such a popular way, and with, you know, these potentially AI tools sending you large blobs of stuff back and forth.
Yes.
Yeah. So my next one is kind of an add-on. There's a plotting library that we've talked about. It has come up multiple times on the show. It's called Plot9. It's a data visualization package for Python, and it's based on the grammar of graphics. It's got a syntax that's similar to an R library called ggplot2, which is very successful and popular inside the R world. And Plot9 is, you know, got its own fans here in Python, especially if you're, you know, working in the data science world or potentially moving back and forth. I like it in a lot of ways because it's very pretty. I'm sorry, Matplotlib. Its default choices for colors and style is appealing to me, and that might be for you also. But one thing that's truly missing from a lot of other libraries is having interactivity. And so that brings me to my project this week. It's by Joseph Barbier-Darnal. He's working inside of this repo called Yellow Sunflower, which seems to be like a group of different people that are working on projects together there. Don't know the entire background. A bunch of interesting projects. It might be worth looking at if you're into data wrangling and visualizing and things like that. The project is called 9JS. So actually mine is JavaScript. So 9JS adds interactive behavior to Plot9 charts with a minimal API. You can attach tooltips, hover, grouping, click on events directly, and then it can export the whole results as a standalone HTML plot. And that HTML then is interactive, which is nice. And it's like 2 lines of code, typically. An import statement like from 9JS, import interactive, comma, save. And then at the tail of the whole thing, interactive, and then the name of the plot plus save, and then whatever you want to save it as, plot.html. So it works out of the box with Jupyter Quarto, which is another tool from the Posit people, Marimo, which we talk about often, and Shiny. It includes a built-in preview in Positron. It supports adding custom CSS and JavaScript. So again, if you want to prettify it and modify it in your own way there, you can. Copy pastable self-contained documentation for AI and agents. So that's nice if you want to do an integration there. I like the documentation. It's pretty nice. It's got a great set of examples and a gallery set up that, of course, are interactive and really show off what you can do. So again, if you're a fan of the grammar of graphics and a fan of interactivity in your plots, you may want to check it out. 9.js. All right, Chris, I think we did it.
Yep. Put a fork in it. It's done.
All right. Well, everybody enjoy this midsummer episode and we'll talk to you soon.
See you in a couple weeks.
With a song. Thanks again to Ori by Endor Labs for supporting the show. Get started for free at endorlabs.com/developer-tools. I want to say thanks to Christopher Trudeau for coming on the show again this week. And I want to thank you for listening. If you like the episode, a great way to help us grow our audience is to share it with other Python users who you think might enjoy it. You can also leave a rating or a review on your podcast platform of choice. If you or your company are interested in sponsoring the podcast, you can find all the information at realpython.com/advertise. You can find show notes with links to the topics we spoke about inside your podcast player or at realpython.com/podcast. And while you're there, you can leave us a question or a topic idea. I've been your host, Christopher Bailey, and I look forward to talking to you soon.